So this is part 6 of 6 of What Happened to Me by Randall Niles. For the other podcasts, resources, and links, go to www.allaboutthejourney.org. So can a rational person accept miracles? Well, actually, I jumped this hurdle pretty quick. You know, for me, the suspension or violation of natural laws involved in the biblical miracles is really no different than what we observe on a day-to-day basis. There are inherent natural forces represented by the laws of physics, chemical properties, mathematical formulae, and there are volitional forces that can interact or counteract with the natural ones. For instance, the laws of gravity that hold a rock to the ground are not suspended or violated when a boy counteracts gravity by applying a greater physical force to pick up and throw the rock. The same logic holds when we read the eyewitness accounts of Jesus walking on water or turning water to wine. From a rational basis, he's merely applying a volitional force outside what we know as the natural laws within our four material dimensions. I mean, I may be philosophically predisposed to dismiss any reference to supernatural events, but that doesn't mean that they can't and don't occur. Given the caveat that there is a God, miracles are very reasonable. A supernatural agent is not logically constrained by the effects of a supernatural cause. Thus, God is not restricted by the naturalistic laws governing our universe. Natural law is God's creation, instituted by God to govern His creation. The Creator is not boxed in by His creation. When considering a supernatural agent, it's logical to think outside the box. Given the reality of a supernatural Creator, the Gospel accounts of the miracles of Jesus are very reasonable. Some believe these texts were inspired by God Himself. However, whether or not you personally hold them in such high esteem, at the very least the Gospels represent four separate historical accounts written by four individual authors who, according to secular criteria, independently document historical events. A philosophical predisposition to disregard anything theological or miraculous is simply no reason to reject the Gospel texts. Again, let's consider the integrity of the Gospel's writers, men willing to suffer intense persecution and even die in the defense of their individual testimonies. As I discussed previously, Luke is generally regarded as one of the greatest historians of antiquity. Dr. John McCrae, professor of New Testament and Archaeology at Wheaton University in Illinois, pretty much sums it up. Quote, "The general consensus of both liberal and conservative scholars is that Luke is very accurate as a historian. He's erudite, he's eloquent, his Greek approaches classical quality, he writes as an educated man, and archaeological discoveries are showing over and over again that Luke is accurate in what he has to say." End quote. Sir William Ramsay, one of the greatest archaeological minds of modern times, agrees. He says, "Luke is a historian of the first rank." End quote. Have we any good reason to discard Luke's account of the life of Jesus? How about the other gospel writers that gave their lives for their written testimonies? What about the resurrection? Now here's the biggie, the core of the whole matter. Did Jesus really rise from the dead, and why is this event so important? Well, in a very simple nutshell, the New Testament is founded on Jesus Christ and the power of His resurrection. Since the foundation of biblical Christianity is Jesus Christ and His resurrection, then the historical veracity of His life, death, and resurrection are tantamount. For as Paul declared in his letter to the Corinthians, quote, "And if Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith. More than that, we are found to be false witnesses about God, for we have testified about God that He raised Christ from the dead," end quote. Now, as an analytical person trained in the law, I found that the only legitimate way to investigate the resurrection of Jesus was to test the historical evidence without presupposition or bias. Therefore, to be fair, I decided to judge the evidence like any other historical event. Based on standard rules of evidence, consistent testimony from multiple credible witnesses would be considered the strongest form of evidence available to a litigant. Therefore, if I found such testimony present in credible accounts of the historical record, I would have satisfied a major evidentiary challenge under traditional rules. In fact, I did find multiple eyewitness testimonies regarding the resurrection of Jesus. In his letter to the Corinthian church, Paul established the following. For what I received I passed on to you as of first importance, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures, and then he appeared to Peter, and then to the 12, and after that he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. Manuscript studies indicate that this was a very early creed of the Christian faith, written within a few years after the death of Jesus Christ. Therefore, it's dramatic that Paul ends the passage with, quote, most of whom are still living, end quote. Paul was inviting people to check out the facts. He wouldn't have included a statement like that if he was trying to hide something like a conspiracy, a hoax, a myth, or a legend. The resurrection of Jesus was also declared in numerous other accounts, including the appearance of Jesus to Mary Magdalene, to the other women, to Cleopas and his companion, to the 11 disciples and others. Then he again appeared to the 10 apostles and others, including Thomas in one episode and excluding Thomas in another. Then again to 7 apostles, then to the disciples, then to the apostles on the Mount of Olives. For me, the ultimate test of credibility for these eyewitnesses was that many of them faced horrible deaths for their eyewitness testimony. As I've said before, this is really dramatic. These witnesses knew the truth. What could they possibly gain by dying for a known lie? The evidence speaks for itself. These weren't just religious faithful dying for a religious belief. These were followers of Jesus dying for a historic event, his resurrection that established him as the Christ, the Son of God. Over time, I found the resurrection of Jesus Christ to be one of the most attested facts of all antiquity. After rising from the dead and before ascending back into heaven, Jesus was seen by hundreds of eyewitnesses, many of whom died unflinchingly for their testimony. Christ's early followers were willing to suffer and die for their story. This established fact attests to the sincerity of their faith and strongly rules out deception on their part. In fact, all but one of the New Testament's writers were executed for proclaiming and defending Christ's resurrection. John alone was spared, but forced into exile by the Roman Emperor Titus Flavius later in his life. Now, granted, martyrdom in and of itself is not unique. I mean, many throughout history have willingly died for their beliefs. What makes the disciples' martyrdom extraordinary to me is that these men were in a position to actually know whether or not what they were professing was true. You see, no one will knowingly suffer horribly and ultimately die a brutal death in order to defend something they know to be a lie. You know, for example, the September 11th suicide hijackers may have sincerely believed in what they died for, but they certainly weren't in a position to know whether or not what they believed was true. They put their faith in religious traditions passed down to them over many generations. In contrast, the New Testament's martyrs either saw what they claimed to see, or they didn't, plain and simple. Either they interacted with the resurrected Jesus, or they didn't. Dramatically, these men clung to their testimonies, even to their brutal deaths at the hands of their persecutors, and this despite being given every chance to recant and knowing full well whether their testimony was true or false. Why would so many men knowingly die for a lie? They had nothing to gain for lying and obviously everything to lose. In addition to the disciples experiencing what they claimed to be resurrection appearances, there were even a few skeptics who believed Jesus had appeared to them alive after the crucifixion. Most biblical scholars today agree that Paul was a skeptic and even a persecutor of the early Christian church prior to experiencing a post-resurrection appearance. Most scholars also agree that James was a skeptic prior to experiencing what he called a post-resurrection appearance. Paul's experience caused him to immediately change from a nasty persecutor of Christianity to one of its most aggressive advocates. He claimed that this change came only after personally interacting with the resurrected Christ, and he willingly suffered and died for his testimony. And prior to Jesus' resurrection, his very own brother James was a skeptic. His experience of a post-resurrection appearance is reported within 5 years of Jesus' crucifixion. And after personally interacting with the risen Christ, James became a leader of the Christian church in Jerusalem. James willingly died for his belief that Jesus was the Messiah who had died and rose again. So I had to ask myself, would someone who was willing to suffer and die a horrible death in defense of the Scriptures be guilty of corrupting those very same Scriptures? I mean, that's crazy. And if that person did corrupt the scriptures, or even allowed them to be corrupted, that would mean he knowingly suffered and died for a lie. It's just human nature. No one suffers and dies for a known lie. Okay, maybe one lunatic, but not a whole group of eyewitnesses. So finally, I took a look at some of the academic scholarship. I was truly surprised to find that a large number of scholars today agree that Christ's tomb was found empty. Consider this, what we call the Jerusalem factor. Since Jesus was publicly executed and buried in Jerusalem, it would have been impossible for Christianity to begin in Jerusalem while the body was still in the tomb. Christ's enemies in the Jewish leadership and the Roman government would only have to exhume the corpse and publicly display it for the hoax to be shattered. There was the Jewish response. And rather point to an occupied tomb, the Jewish leadership accused Christ's disciples of stealing his body. Wouldn't this strategy seem to establish that there was, in fact, a missing body? What about the woman's testimony? In all four gospel accounts of the empty tomb, women are listed as the primary witnesses. This would be an odd invention, since in both Jewish and Roman cultures, women were not esteemed and their testimony was not even admissible in court. Quote, when you understand the role of women in first century Jewish society, what's really extraordinary is that this empty tomb story should feature women as the discoverers of the empty tomb in the first place. Women were of a very low rung of the social ladder in first century Palestine. There are old rabbinical sayings that said, let the words of the law be burned rather than delivered to a woman, and blessed is he whose children are male, but woe to him whose children are female. Women's testimony was regarded as so worthless that they weren't even allowed to serve as legal witnesses in a Jewish court of law. Well, in light of this, it's absolutely remarkable that the chief witnesses to the empty tomb are women. Any later legendary account would have certainly portrayed male disciples as discovering the tomb, Peter or John, for example. The fact that women are the first witnesses to enter the empty tomb is most plausibly explained by the reality that, like it or not, they were the discoverers of the empty tomb. This shows that the gospel writers faithfully recorded what happened, even if it was embarrassing. This bespeaks the historicity of this tradition rather than its legendary status. That was all a quote by William Lane Craig. Okay, so if I'm a lawyer and I'm viewing this evidence through legal goggles, what am I missing? I mean, anything? Surely other analytical legal minds have weighed this evidence. Well, again, I was truly stunned to find that great legal minds had already done this. Check these guys out. Simon Greenleaf, who died in 1853, was one of the founders of Harvard Law School. He authored the three-volume text. I mean, this is the authoritative text on the law of evidence. And it was published in 1842, and it's still considered the greatest single authority on evidence in the entire literature of legal procedure. Greenleaf literally wrote the rules of evidence for the U.S. legal system. I read it in law school. He was certainly a man who knew how to weigh the facts. He was an atheist until he accepted a challenge by his students to investigate the case for Christ's resurrection. After personally collecting and examining the evidence based on rules of evidence that he helped establish, Greenleaf became a Christian and wrote the classic book, Testimony of the Evangelists. Quote, let the gospel's testimony be sifted as if it were given in a court of justice on the side of the adverse party, the witness being subjected to a rigorous cross-examination. The result, it is confidently believed, will be an undoubting conviction of their integrity, ability, and truth. End quote. So on to another one. Sir Lionel Luckhoo, who died in recently, 1997, is considered one of the greatest lawyers in British history. He's recorded in the Guinness Book of World Records as the, quote, world's most successful advocate, end quote. 245 consecutive murder acquittals. He was knighted by Queen Elizabeth II twice. He declared, quote, I humbly add, I have spent more than 42 years as a defense trial lawyer, appearing in many parts of the world, and I am still in active practice. I have been fortunate to secure a number of successes in jury trials, and I say unequivocally, the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ is so overwhelming that it compels acceptance by proof, which leaves absolutely no room for doubt, end quote. Lee Strobel, a Yale-educated, award-winning journalist at the Chicago Tribune, as an atheist, he decided to compile a legal case against Jesus Christ and prove him to be a fraud by the weight of the evidence. As legal editor of the Tribune, Strobel's area of expertise was courtroom analysis. To make his case against Christ, Strobel cross-examined a number of Christian authorities, recognized experts in their own fields of study, PhDs from academic centers like Cambridge and Princeton, Brandeis University. He conducted his examination with no religious bias other than his predisposition to atheism. Remarkably, after compiling and critically examining the evidence for himself, Strobel became a Christian. Stunned by his findings, he organized the evidence into a book called The Case for Christ, which won the Gold Medallion Book Award for Excellence. Strobel asks one thing of each reader: remain unbiased in your examination of the evidence. In the end, judge the evidence for yourself, acting as the lone juror in The Case for Christ. Well, as a lone juror, you know, I sat quiet. You know, as jurors often do in the jury room, I was at a point where, you know, I had to ask to return once again to a provoking piece of evidence. Well, since this was so powerful to me, I wanted to return to the testimony of persecution and death, the early followers of Jesus. I want to re-examine the dramatic part of early Christian history. Like me, any skeptic who holds to a notion that the resurrection of Jesus Christ was a man-made legend created after the fact by a group of religious zealots should sincerely check out the legacy of what we call martyrdom. You know, 11 of the 12 apostles and many other early disciples died for their adherence to this story. This is so spectacular, since they all witnessed the alleged events surrounding Jesus and his resurrection, and still went to their deaths defending them. Why is this spectacular? When many throughout history have died martyred deaths for a religious belief? Because people don't die for a lie. Look at human nature throughout history. No conspiracy can be maintained when life or liberty is at stake. Dying for a belief is one thing, but numerous eyewitnesses dying for a known lie, well, that's quite another. Okay, I guess I've made my point on that one. Here's an account of early Christian persecution, as compiled from numerous sources outside the Bible, the most famous of which is Fox's Christian Martyrs of the World. Around 34 AD, 1 year after the crucifixion of Jesus, Stephen was thrown out of Jerusalem and stoned to death. Approximately 2,000 Christians suffered martyrdom in Jerusalem during this period. About 10 years later, we see James, the son of Zebedee and the elder brother of John, who was killed by Herod Agrippa as he arrived to be governor of Judea. Agrippa detested the Christian sect of Jews, and many early disciples were martyred under his rule, including Timon, Parmenas, a number of others. Around 54 AD, Philip, a disciple from Bethsaida in Galilee, suffered martyrdom at Heliopolis in Phrygia. He was scourged, thrown into prison, and afterwards crucified. About 6 years later, Matthew, the tax collector from Nazareth, who wrote one of the Gospels, was preaching in Ethiopia when he suffered martyrdom by the sword. James, the brother of Jesus, administered the early church in Jerusalem and was the author of a biblical text by his name. Well, he was beat and stoned and finally had his brains bashed out with a fuller's club. Matthias was the apostle who filled the vacant place of Judas. He was stoned at Jerusalem and then beheaded. Andrew was the brother of Peter, who preached throughout Asia. On his arrival at Edessa, he was arrested and crucified on a cross, and the two ends of which they were fixed transversely in the ground, and this is where we get the term St. Andrew's Cross. Mark was converted to Christianity by Peter, and then transcribed Peter's account of Jesus in his gospel. Mark was dragged to pieces by the people of Alexandria in front of Serapis, their pagan idol. It appears Peter was condemned to death and crucified at Rome, and Jerome holds that Peter was crucified upside down at his own request because he said he was unworthy to be crucified in the same manner of his Lord. Paul suffered in the first persecution under Nero, and Paul's faith was so dramatic in the face of martyrdom that the authorities removed him to a private place for execution by the sword. About 72 AD, Jude, the brother of James, who is commonly called Thaddeus, he was crucified at Edessa. Bartholomew preached in several countries and translated the Gospel of Matthew into the language of India. He was cruelly beaten and then crucified by idolaters there. Thomas, called Didymus, preached in Parthia in India, and he was thrust through with a spear by a group of pagan priests there. Luke was the author of the gospel under his name. He traveled with Paul through various countries and is supposed to have been hanged on an olive tree by these idolatrous priests in Greece. Barnabas of Cyprus, he was killed without many known facts in about 73 AD. Simon, he preached in Africa and even in Britain, where he was crucified about 74 AD. John, the beloved disciple, was the brother of James. From Ephesus, he was ordered to Rome, where he was actually cast into a cauldron of boiling oil, and he escaped by eyewitnesses said it was a miracle, without injury. And so Emperor banished him then to the Isle of Patmos, where he wrote the last book of the Bible, Revelation. He was the only apostle who escaped a violent death. So Christian persecution, it didn't slow the growth of the Christian faith during the first few centuries after Jesus. I mean, even as its early leaders died these horrible deaths, Christianity flourished throughout the Roman Empire. How can this historical record of martyrdom be viewed as anything but powerful evidence for the truth of the Christian faith? A faith grounded in historical events and eyewitness testimonies. So, what is Christian faith anyway? Where am I with all this? Where has this journey taken me, and how should it impact my life? I intellectually believe that certain things happened in history, but what does that really mean for my life today? What is belief? What is faith? Although the Christian faith is not based purely on evidence, it's definitely supported by the evidence. Faith is not about turning off the brain and merely relying on the heart or squashing reason in favor of emotion. No, Christian faith is about seeking and knowing Jesus with all facets of the human character. It's not a blind faith as I once thought, it's a calculated faith based on a preponderance of the evidence. Well, I've collected the evidence and I've put it on trial, and after a number of months in the jury room, I have returned with my personal verdict. Jesus Christ is who he claims to be, the Son of God who came to this earth about 2,000 years ago to offer true and lasting hope for mankind. Okay, now what? I intellectually believe, by a preponderance of the evidence, that God exists, that the Bible is true, and that Jesus is his Son. How does this affect me? You know, I love the metaphor of a chair. You'll find the chair closest to you and look at it closely. Examine its design. Is it structurally sound? Is it sufficiently engineered? Will the materials chosen by the manufacturer support your weight? Most likely, you picked a chair that you believe will support you. Well, that's belief. You applied logic and knowledge and experience to make an informed intellectual decision. Now sit in the chair. That's faith. At one point, intellectual assent only goes so far. True living requires that we put our beliefs into action. Intellectual belief without actionable faith, it's hollow, it's meaningless. Have you ever heard the story about the guy who walked a tightrope across Niagara Falls? I mean, many people watched him do it, and to them he asked, "Do you believe I can walk a tightrope across the falls?" And they all replied, "Yes," because they had already seen him do it. And then he pushed a wheelbarrow on a tightrope across Niagara Falls. And when he completed the feat, he asked the onlookers, "Do you believe I can walk a tightrope across the falls pushing a wheelbarrow?" And to that they replied unanimously, "Yes," because they just saw him do it. Finally, a buddy of the tightrope walker climbs into the wheelbarrow, and the tightrope walker pushes him across the falls. I mean, what a daring feat! And when they finish, the tightrope walker asks the crowd, "Do you believe I can walk a tightrope across the falls pushing a wheelbarrow with a person in it?" And to that they exclaimed, "Yes," for they were now believers in this guy's awesome abilities. And then he looked at the crowd and he asked, "Who's next?" Well, there you have it. That's belief versus faith. So let's get to it. Jesus Christ at the core. Why has the name Jesus Christ caused more division, agitation, controversy than any other name in history? Come on, why? If I bring up God in a coffee shop discussion, nobody's really offended. If I speak of Buddha or Brahma or Moses or Muhammad, I really don't irritate the listener. However, the name Jesus Christ seems to cut right to the soul. It did for me. And when people brought up the other religious and philosophical leaders of history, I usually participated in some sort of intellectual discussion. When people tried to discuss Jesus with me, though, I felt that my space had been violated. Well, what right did this person have to challenge me in my worldview? I found that something makes Jesus more contentious and convicting than all other religious leaders combined. Really, what is it? Unlike any other widely followed religious leader in history, Jesus Christ made a unique claim. He declared himself God. Not a God, not God-like, but God incarnate, the creator of the universe in human flesh. Intellectually, that's very disturbing. Spiritually, that's a direct attack on everything comfortable and coexisting in my safe little world. For me, I retreated to the typical responses to the life and claims of Jesus. I mean, depending on the stage of my life, they sounded something like, you know, Jesus was a great man, Jesus was a nice moral model, Jesus was an esteemed teacher, Jesus was a religious prophet. You know, however, Christian scholar Josh McDowell put it really well in his foundational book, More Than a Carpenter. He said, these types of statements, they raise a big old problem. You know, once you examine the actual claims of Jesus and his eyewitness followers, there are only three alternatives for who he really is. I mean, Jesus Christ was either a liar, or a lunatic, or our Lord. Quote, the issue with these three alternatives is not which is possible, for it's obvious that all three are possible, but rather the question is, which is more probable? Who you decide Jesus Christ is must not be an idle intellectual exercise. You cannot put him on the shelf as a great moral teacher. That's not a valid option. He's either a liar, a lunatic, or Lord and God. You must make a choice. But as the Apostle John wrote, these have been written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and more important, that believing you might have life in his name. C.S. Lewis, a popular British theologian, he continues, I'm trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing that we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level with the man who says he's a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for the fool. You can spit on him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. End quote. You know, please understand, I am not selling religion here. If anything, I still believe that religion has kept more people from God than anything else in history. Actually, I've discovered that true Christianity isn't a religion at all. It's discovering and establishing a relationship with God. It's trusting in Jesus and what he did on the cross for you and me, not on what we can do for ourselves. True Christianity isn't about organized religion. It's not about hierarchical structures and ornate buildings and flamboyant preachers or traditional rules and rituals. In fact, let's just drop the Christianity label altogether. Simply, it's pursuing and reconciling three basic questions of life. One, does God exist? And if so, what am I going to do about it? Two, is the Bible true? And if so, what does that mean for me? Three, who is Jesus? If he is who he claims to be, how will this reality really change my life? Again, it's not about religion at all. It's not about the man-made machine we know today as Christianity. It's all about Jesus. He's either the Son of God who offers the only true hope for the world, or he's not. Done. So now what? Why did I write this book and share it with you? Because I went on an incredible, life-changing journey, and I'm excited about that. I hit a season in my life where I started asking questions again. I started challenging my own worldview. I woke up from a long slumber and opened my eyes a little wider. My only hope is that you'll start some kind of journey in your life. Ask some questions, explore some assumptions, examine some long-held preconceptions about life and purpose and meaning. If you were selected for a jury in a real trial, you would be asked to affirm up front that you haven't formed any preconceptions about the case. You would be required to vow that you would be open-minded and fair, drawing your conclusions based on the weight of the facts and not your whims or prejudice. You would be urged to thoughtfully consider the credibility of the witnesses, carefully sift the testimony, and rigorously subject the evidence to your common sense and logic. Ultimately, it's the responsibility of jurors to reach a verdict. That doesn't mean they have 100% certainty, because we can't have absolute proof about anything in life. In a trial, jurors are asked to weigh the evidence and come to the best possible conclusion. That comes from Lee Strobel's Case for Christ. You know, in no way do I think your journey has to mirror mine. My only hope and prayer is that you'll start an honest quest. Well, that's the end of What Happened to Me by Randall Niles. Please visit www.allaboutthejourney.org for any other materials, resources, tools, and podcasts. Thanks very much for listening.